Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast. I say your podcast. It's actually Laura, Adam and my podcast, but you can kid yourselves if you want. Your podcast dedicated to all things cycling and walking in the UK and beyond, which we claim every week. I hope it's true. I hope someone out there is listening. My name is Ned Bolting.
I'm Laura Laker.
And I'm Adam Tranter.
Now, in this episode, we do have a guest who's going to be joining us fairly shortly. And that is Katie Pennick, who is from the Transport for All organisation. And we're going to be talking about accessibility for disabled people, amongst other things, with Katie, because she's done some excellent research into that, as have her organisation. So that's still to come, Laura and Adam. But before then, before Katie joins us, there are one or two bits of news, aren't there, of kind of relevance, well, really, to stuff we've been talking about now for the past year. Some interesting research, Adam, which has emerged courtesy of Professor, as I now understand she is, Rachel Aldred.
Yeah, that's right. There's a new study out that says that low traffic schemes benefit the most deprived Londoners, according to the really quite in-depth research here. So it examined around 400 filters created in London over the last year. And of course, a lot of the discussion from people who are opposed to LTNs is that they tend to shunt vehicles from richer residential areas onto roads lived in by more deprived people. And that doesn't seem to be the case. It's been using this data modelling to compare streets, including occupants' age, ethnicity, disability, employment, car ownership, and the government's own index of multiple deprivation. And so they're able to work down to micro areas of around 300 residents, and people without cars were more likely to live in an LTN, and Black, Asian and minority ethnic Londoners were slightly more likely to live in LTNs than white residents, although this did vary by ethnicity, with Asian people slightly less to do so. So yeah, this is really interesting stuff, and it's kind of caused, like as you would expect, a debate on the data, and really this is quite detailed stuff, and it reminds me of this thing we keep coming back to, is the original kind of comment was show us the data, and now it's no, not that data. That data's wrong from the opponents, and that seems a little unfair, because this is really, really in depth stuff from a leading professional.
The data, from my reading of it, Laura, did seem to suggest that, and I think Adam kind of almost alluded to it there, that whilst it's incredibly positive in certain boroughs and certain areas, it is actually, because these schemes are put in under the auspices of each individual borough council in London, of which there are many different types and many full stop. It's a bit different from borough to borough, isn't it? So, and quite markedly so in some respects. I mean, certain boroughs have treated LTNs in fundamentally differing ways, and it's had a differing outcome. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, so you've got Hackney, which is probably the most ambitious borough for having LTNs that it's already done. The research found that implementation in Hackney was very equitable, and that the most deprived half of London areas were 18% more likely to live in an LTN. Enfield, I think it was, those LTNs focused on one of the most affluent areas of the borough. And they said that was because people in that area had been talking about they wanted these kind of schemes. And that way of implementing stuff, like, so local people who've got the, the social capital to be able to call for these schemes tend to be better off, tend to have more spare time. And so that will kind of skew towards the better off people. So I think they're going to introduce more schemes. And of course, they did a really good cycle route, which they say is going to sort of link in with LTNs as they go forward.
And it is difficult because the narrative that we keep talking about week on week that's really polarizing does sometimes start to lean towards, well, you know, we should listen to residents, and every LTN should have a, you know, a referendum because they've worked brilliantly. If people like it, they should get them. And as we've seen in Enfield, perhaps, is the ones that are most likely to say yes, it doesn't necessarily do the purpose and the job of the LTNs can do. And I'd also say it's so I think that's dangerous because as this narrative continues to become more polarized, there is a chance that councils will potentially take the easy option, inverted commas, where they're going to get least amount of aggro, and that's not good for the equity of our transport system. And ultimately, that's how we ended up in this problem in the first place, where people from wealthy neighbourhoods can drive where they like and have access to all forms of transport.
I was just going to say, I don't think it's that there's more support among people who've got more money. I think it's more that they're more likely to sort of call for these measures in the first place. They're more likely to have the confidence and the time to and the contact to call for these measures. So
that's what you meant by when you used the phrase social capital, isn't it? I think.
Yeah.
That kind of being tuned into the mechanisms to get these things done and actually being engaged with it, I suppose, with the process.
Well, I mean, most people wouldn't write to their local council. It would be a totally nuts thing to do. Like before I started doing this, you know, I wrote to my local council to request a new wheelie bin, and that was like the first time I'd ever engaged with my local council. So
they get wheelie bins, dog mess, parking, basically. That's what you get as a councillor.
I did that. I did that just the other day, actually. I wrote to my council for the first time in my life, Adam, requesting a new wheelie bin. Because mine had been nicked. Classic. Who nicks wheelie bins, by the way? It's really weird, isn't it?
Who does that?
What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. So my question was about, there's a comment I think, Adam, you made as a result of the research into LTNs, that car ownership amongst Londoners tends to reflect socioeconomic circumstances of households. In other words, the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to have a car. But which I'm sure is true, otherwise it wouldn't have been found to be the case in the report. But on the other hand, is there any information about generational shifting like that? So if you use the age as the determining factor, is there evidence emerging that younger people are less likely to than at my generation was perhaps before to own a car in London?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. That's clear as day. Londoners are becoming less and less likely to own a car. And I think the most popular is like Londoners in their 70s who were, you know, grew up in the heyday of the motor car, who not only own more cars, use more cars, etc. And of course, that fits also into a certain voting demographic, and also fits into a certain demographic of the kind of people who would write into their council other than to request a wheelie bin, potentially, with a bit more time on their hands. And that's also reflected in who local councillors are, actually, as well. There are a lot of, I don't have the data in front of me, but a lot of local councillors are 50s, in their 50s, 60s and 70s. So all of that is lending itself to potentially those who stand most to benefit from increased active travel measures having the least amount of say in that.
Yeah, and there's two sides to the kind of income and transport issue in terms of air pollution and road danger. And if you're on a low income, you're more likely to live somewhere that's got dangerous roads, poor provision for walking and cycling, and high levels of air pollution, which of course have kind of lifelong impacts on you.
There was this really weird thing as well that, you know, prior to this report being published, and I'm sure is still out there, this theory or this argument perpetuated that somehow these LTNs being placed where they are is driving up house prices, and it's actually just to the benefit of the people, you know, which is a really kind of tricky one to try and get your head around, because in effect, they probably do, but because as we, you know, over the long term, because that's what we were talking about recently, wasn't it? These legacy LTNs that were put in decades ago sometimes, I would imagine the houses on those streets are probably a little bit more expensive than they would otherwise be if that LTN hadn't been put in there. So there's some truth in that as well, isn't there?
Yeah, I think there's a couple in kind of outer London in the kind of suburban areas, and they're not particularly wealthy areas. There's one in Leicester that's quite old, and that's in an area that hasn't really gentrified, but that's kind of, Leicester's a different thing, and they've got kind of different demographics, different population, and different kind of changing patterns. But I think it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because any improvement to the street, especially in sort of cities where spaces at a premium, house prices are going up, rental prices are going up, anything that kind of improves the area is going to cause concern for people on low incomes or people who are renting and don't want their prices to go up.
Also in London, especially where this analysis was done about house prices, one, house prices aren't a good indicator of social deprivation because, you know, the data isn't super accurate. And also people could be renting, for example, a house that's worth a lot of money. So it doesn't necessarily mean that those people are benefiting. And also I used to live in Fulham, and I used to live in a kind of what I would call a normal flat in Fulham, like built in the 70s or 80s, and behind me there was two big council tower blocks, and in front of me there were £5 million mansions on the King's Road, and all within probably the same square mileage of assessment. So it's really, really, I think, quite a blunt instrument to look at house prices and say, oh, that's who's benefiting. That's a disappointing one, I think.
Yeah, I often think that is quite a unique London story, isn't it? That way that the housing market is kind of structured and dysfunctional. But on the other hand, it's kind of quite interesting about London. I've always felt that, you know, that it's not so clearly segregated in some ways, and in other ways it is deeply. LTN news though, while we wait for Katie to join the call, it'd be a shame if we didn't use the jingle, because Adam, I think there is some more. I mean, we've just done a bit of LTN news, but there's a bit more data that's just emerged, so maybe we could have the jingle and you can bring us up to date.
There is breaking LTN news.
Live from the Streets Ahead newsroom, it's LTN.
Claire Holland, who's the cabinet member for Lambeth, responsible for transport, has revealed the data from the monitoring of the Railton low traffic neighbourhood in South London, showing that car traffic down is 31% across the area, HGVs are down 23% across the area, and cycling is up 32% across the area and up 51% within the low traffic neighbourhood. And a lot of discussion is always around what happens to the roads and the boundary roads, and the traffic around boundary roads is also showing that to be down as well. So Loughborough Junction is down 7%, Brixton End of Cold Harbour Lane is down 10%. So it's showing that the LTN is doing pretty much what it's supposed to do.
Lambeth has been one of those boroughs that's been particularly behind the LTN scheme and has also attracted some of the most fierce criticism as well. So that kind of seems to be part of the parcel. I'm very pleased to say, though, our guest has logged in and signed up and joined us. Hello, Katie. My name's Ned. Nice to meet you.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for taking the time. Adam and Laura, I guess you know much better than me. We're meeting for the first time. Just to introduce, and this time we're talking about Pave the Way, an influential report by disabled transport charity by the name of Transport for All, and that's why we're talking to Katie, about the impact of emergency active travel measures on disabled people, and very importantly, the improvements that are needed. So, Katie Pennick, this is our kind of second consecutive episode where we tried as three non-disabled people to get our heads around this incredibly important subject that, you know, by ourselves and other people seems to be permanently overlooked in the discussion. In the last episode, we spoke to, I'm sure someone you know extremely well, Isabel Clement, who was incredibly enlightening in all sorts of ways. But I think
she is great.
The conversation we had with Isabel was partly predicated on the work that you had done prior to that. So I guess, tell us what it was in the first place, this study, Katie.
Those are very big shoes to fill. I am big fan of Isabel Clement. She is absolutely brilliant. And great that you've got a chance to speak to her as well. So just to reiterate, I'm Katie, I'm from Transport for All, which is a disabled people's organisation that campaigns for accessible public transport and inclusive street design. And we're a membership organisation, so we have 400 members. We're pan-impairment, so we represent the interests of disabled people from all the impairment groups. So not just wheelchair users like myself, but blind and visually impaired people, deaf and hard of hearing people, neurodivergent people, everyone. And we were sort of alerted to this. I mean, we've done a lot of work on street space issues in the past. We've sort of done campaigning for more dropped curbs, for instance, on pavements. We've campaigned against street clutter. We've done a lot of work with micromobility and kind of dockless bikes and e-scooters. It's sort of been all kind of ticking along in the background, but nothing we have done has ever gotten a huge deal of traction. But low traffic neighbourhoods came along and has really just lit the conversation on fire. As I'm sure you're all aware of, for some reason, low traffic neighborhoods is I don't know what it is. It's explosive, isn't it? It's got everyone talking about it. And it has been heated, shall we say, incredibly controversial at points. The conversation, especially online, is incredibly polarized. People do feel very passionate about it. And I think at least a good thing about all of this is that it has shone a light on this issue about who our streets are for. And that's something that we have been sort of talking about for all of this time and advocating for improved accessibility in our street space. On the low traffic neighbourhoods front and the reason that we did this research, it started about in June last year, that we started getting a lot of inquiries, a lot of comments, a lot of questions from our members and from the wider disabled community about these new schemes that were being introduced, all by kind of different names. It was like healthy streets, people-friendly streets, all of these kind of pseudonyms. And there was just a great deal of concern, a great deal of anxiety from a lot of disabled people living in various areas that changes were being made very suddenly, very quickly, and without asking beforehand, I think, was the key difference. And we looked into this. We started looking into a few kind of target boroughs. Initially, we looked at Lambeth and Tower Hamlets and Islington. And we found that this was kind of a pattern was emerging, that disabled people were feeling very concerned that these changes were being made. And what we found was that the usual level of consultation and engagement that we would usually expect to see when changes like this were being made weren't happening at all. That equality and impact assessments were often not being done, or where they were being done, weren't being written by people who had the sort of level of
expertise and knowledge about accessibility that we would kind of like to expect. So it was really kind of a splattergun approach that changes were being made a bit haphazardly, and so the impacts were really greatly felt, which is what prompted this research. We looked into this. We conducted this huge, large-scale study, qualitative study. We spoke to, we recruited 84 disabled people, including some carers / parents of disabled people from all across London. I think we spoke to people in 19 out of the 21 boroughs where new low traffic neighbourhoods had been put in, a whole range of ages. We spoke to people age 8 to 89 from across the impairment groups, to really find out how they felt about these changes.
And so the response was, you got a really kind of good range of different needs and different impairments, didn't you? And you got some really interesting case studies to kind of illustrate some of the issues that people were having with these schemes. And some of them were quite kind of simple tweaks, like it's about something as simple as moving a planter that was in the way of a drop curb. But of course, there's kind of longer term issues as well.
Yeah. So I think to zoom out a bit from kind of the details, we found a real range of opinion. I think one of the very frustrating things that has happened about in the way in which low traffic neighbourhoods have been talked about is because it's so polarised, it's sort of like a zero-sum game. You know, you're either for them all or you're against them all, which is quite reductive and not really how it works. And actually, we found that disabled people really held a real range of views on this. There were people who reported real positive impacts, and there were people who reported really negative impacts. And that's kind of a point about disabled people. You know, we're not a homogenous group. We're not all the same person having exactly the same experience. But I think common to quite a lot of people's experience was frustration at the way in which often disabled people and disability and our needs have been used a bit as a bit of a political point scorer by people on both sides of the argument. So we hear a lot of kind of concerned individuals saying, what about these disabled people? You know, how are they going to get around? Which is very frustrating. But we also hear sort of people who are very advocating for low traffic neighbourhoods saying these are fantastic for disabled people because they can roll their wheelchair down the middle of the street, and that's wonderful. And it always just goes back to, okay, why don't you just ask us? Why don't you just ask us for our opinion and we can give you that? And so that was kind of the core of this research. And so, yeah, in terms of positive views, positive impacts of low traffic neighbourhoods, there were loads of them. So for people, particularly those living inside a low traffic neighbourhood, they experienced a reduction in traffic, in vehicles on the roads, and the associated benefits of that. So less traffic meant that the streets were quieter, which means there was less noise, which meant there was less sensory overload, which was particularly welcomed by people who were neurodivergent. It led to often more pleasant, more safer journeys. There was a wonderful story of a man I spoke to who was a parent of a young primary school age child who was visually impaired. And he was saying, you know, his son is around about the age now where he wants to start walking to school by himself. His older brother is doing it, all his mates are doing it. But at that time, they, as parents, they just felt that it really wasn't safe for him to walk to school because he's visually impaired, that there's an added layer kind of danger there of not being able to see when the cars are coming, feeling safe crossing the road. And, you know, he was saying, with the low traffic neighbourhood going in, I actually feel safe. I feel comfortable allowing my child to walk to school. That's freedom and independence that he has that he wouldn't otherwise have, which was a really kind of wonderful story to hear from him. It was really interesting speaking to him, saying he said, people expect me to be against these schemes because of my visually impaired son. And it's that kind of yeah, that expectation that actually isn't the case. In a lot of instances, low traffic neighborhoods were encouraging some disabled people to do more active travel journeys, so to walk more, to cycle more. People who were cycling and walking more reported a huge increase to their physical health, to their mental health, you know, all of the kind of the benefits that you were kind of wanted to see from low traffic neighborhoods, which was all great and really great to see. However, I think the key element to this was, is that these benefits couldn't, unfortunately, be enjoyed by everyone, because there were a huge number of disabled people that we talked to who faced kind of additional barriers to active travel, who weren't able to access these benefits, and who also, on top of that, were negatively impacted. So for people who rely on the car as pretty much their only, the only form of transport that is available to them, these are the people who are very disproportionately impacted. And these people reported an increase in their journey time. And that's, you know, that's understandable to see. You know, low traffic neighborhoods are meant to inconvenience driving and are meant to make short car journeys longer. But for these people, you know, longer journeys in the car were more exhausting. In some instances, there was worsening of impairments, particularly if you're sitting down for a longer time. Longer time spent in the car was more expensive, more money spent on petrol, more money spent on taxi fares. You know, I heard from someone who is on Universal Credit who was saying it really isn't a case of, oh, it's only 10 minutes more in the car, you know, that's fine. I'm, you know, counting pennies, and I just simply cannot afford that much more in petrol. And it's now got to a stage where I'm having to make extremely difficult decisions based on which trips I now do. There were implications for carers, particularly people who were kind of providing care and support for multiple people across London. You know, this doesn't happen just in one borough, but people making trips from place to place who have to use the car, who were facing longer journeys, which meant that was actually less time spent with their client. So disabled people actually receiving less care. And this is obviously being compounded by the impact of COVID, which is a huge topic in itself. But, you know, COVID has really hugely impacted disabled people and access to kind of help and care in that way as well. So these were huge negatives. And I think it's really difficult to have conversations about low traffic neighborhoods and zoom in to the details of, you know, the minutiae of which bollards are placed where, because for us, certainly, it's actually about zooming out and it's about looking at low traffic neighborhoods in the context of what is really an increasingly inaccessible and hostile transport system. And I talked about these group of people who don't have access to the benefits of low traffic neighborhoods. These are the people who, you know, we're really concerned about, because they don't feel the impact of low traffic neighborhoods, and they don't have access to other forms of transport. You know, in London, only 81 out of the 270 tube stations have some degree of step-free access. I say step-free, that's what TfL says, step-free, but actually in half of those stations, there is still a step to get onto the train. You know, it's step-free is only down to the platform, but then there is a step to get on the train. You have to get a manual boarding ramp out. And then there's issues there with sometimes the staff don't have the key to the ramp, or the staff, there's miscommunication. They don't meet you off the other side with a ramp. So we're talking a handful of tube stations which are kind of independently accessible. There are problems with buses when ramps fail, when the buses are full, when buggies are in the priority spaces. And again, you know, talking about the streets as well, the streets are incredibly inaccessible. There's a huge problem with street clutter, with the lack of drop curbs, with A-boards. This is being exacerbated by COVID and the kind of social distancing measures. And then beyond the kind of infrastructure barriers to transport, there's also, you know, the even broader societal barriers as well. So for someone who wants to take up cycling, who's a disabled cyclist, there are huge barriers there. Financial, the adapted hand cycles and trikes and cargo bikes, especially ones that have power-assisted steering, are incredibly expensive. A lot of disabled people don't know about this option, aren't aware that they are able to cycle, that this is an option for them. There is a huge amount of stigma towards using a mobility aid. So for people who have mobility impairments but who are ambulatory, so can walk a bit, there is a real kind of, people are really off put by using wheelchairs because of the stigma, because you do face harassment and you do face, you know, stares when you're out and about. So people would rather walk a bit and get in their car, and that's completely understandable. So I've kind of touched on a billion different things there. I feel really like I've just rambled on, but it's a collection of a huge wide range of factors, which is why the conversation is so huge.
Katie, what would be the most straightforward and acceptable solution to this quite intractable problem that you've outlined about car usage for people who need the car? I mean, I've got a friend who lives in Manchester who I've been thinking about while you've been talking, who gets around in a power chair and absolutely drives this great big adapted, very expensive van as well, that hoists him up into the back and slides the chair into the driving position. And then he's got an adapted kind of console. So this is expensive, big kit, but it's absolutely fundamental to his life and getting around and all this sort of thing, as you've described. If I'm sort of placing him in an LTN now and wondering whether or not there's a solution to that problem. I guess in an ideal world, the barriers, the modal filters, would be smart enough to recognize when his car is coming and going and to give him a pass, right? Would that be the best way of approaching it?
Well, that solution already exists, and certainly we've seen that rolled out, I think, in Sutton and Ealing. So that's using ANPR camera technology that would be able to recognise the registration number of vehicles and allow the people who need it to drive through the barriers. So this isn't just for disabled people, but this is also for school transport, for example. So there is that technology that exists. Certainly what we would advocate for is the de-pairing of blue badges with impairment, because usually when things like this happen, often dispensation is offered to blue badge holders. But out of the people that we spoke to, only about half of our participants actually had a blue badge. And something that came up time and time again in our conversations, and also something that we're intimately familiar with the rest of the work that we do, is that disabled people really struggle getting blue badges. The eligibility criteria is still very narrow. The application process is difficult, especially for people with invisible impairments or fluctuating impairments. There are so many issues around that. So we wouldn't want to see a sort of like easy, okay, blue badges can drive through the barriers, job done. It's a little bit more complicated than that, to ensure that everyone who needs that dispensation has it. Also, you know, some of these barriers, depending on the schemes, aren't removable. I mean, you can't move a planter, whoever's driving through, which is more difficult. I don't know. Obviously, every scheme is very different, on a local level, every street is very different. There's no one size fits all solution. What we are advocating for is better engagement with disabled people and disabled residents. So obviously these schemes have been put in with no consultation. Prior to that, usually what would happen is you had some degree of consultation. You know, you had an open public consultation where a council would demonstrate their plans and the members of the public could comment on it. What we're advocating for is a kind of move towards a far more co-produced model of designing schemes. The idea of starting out with a blank canvas, the acknowledgement that you don't know what will work for disabled people, and inviting disabled experts to contribute and help shape these schemes and draw up plans in such a way that will actually benefit the most people and not exclude people.
And would you say that councils are listening since the report has come out? Have you noticed any, you know, olive branches being, you know, we got it wrong, we're going to do better? Because I think everybody can probably agree that the consultation process has been suboptimal for everybody, and I think that's one of the big realizations of these schemes. You've got to take people even away from the kind of critical need to consult in relation to people's accessibility. You have to bring people along on a journey with you anyway, because you need to explain why you're doing this, how the status quo isn't acceptable, all of these things. And that's not been done very well. So have you noticed any change since the report's been released?
Yeah, a huge amount of change. I mean, we're absolutely chuffed with the impact that our work has had. It's really wonderful to see the way in which this has been picked up. A lot of things have happened. Obviously, in a moment of serendipity, about 2 days before we published our report, obviously we got the High Court ruling, which essentially said all of the same things that we put in our conclusion. So that was useful in terms of getting people to notice. In terms of on the engagement issue, I think I completely agree. Like, I don't think anyone looks back at the past year and looks at how the schemes were put in and thinks, yeah, that was great. That was really, really good. I think that we are obviously aware of the huge constraints that everyone has been working under. And we have heard from a huge number of local authorities who've got in touch to say, we totally understand that the way things that were done is not the best way to get people on board. And we want to do better moving forward. We're really keen to understand the ways in which we can design schemes that will not just not exclude disabled people, but actually benefit disabled people. And we are now working or in the process of kind of drawing up plans for partnerships with a whole range of local authorities across the UK, which is really good to see. In terms of TfL's response, that is an ongoing conversation. I think we're waiting for their sort of like official response to what we have suggested. I think that will be coming out in the next week or so. But I know that they are working on redoing their guidance to boroughs for kind of implementing new schemes going forward. I think just the biggest thing we want to see is, you know, this is something that we kept talking about in our report. What we had before wasn't good enough either. So we don't want things to go back to the way they were before. We want things to go forward. We want to see change. We want to see things progress. And at the heart of that is engaging with disabled people. And this idea of starting out with a blank canvas, I think, is really important. So often, speaking from my own kind of lived experience here, so often I'm invited to give my views on a scheme, on a proposed change to something. And it's really frustrating when you kind of get invited to give your view on something and you realize that that decision has already been made. And at the point of which you've been brought in to comment, you are really effectively commenting on the window dressing at that point. All of the big decisions have been made and you're kind of commenting on the color of it or something, which is really, really hard, because accessibility really isn't something that can be tacked on at the end. It just doesn't work like that. Something that is really fundamental to us is the idea that accessibility is as important as any of those other huge big ticket things: sustainability, health and safety, all of these things. These are decisions that are made at the beginning. You can't make them in retrospect. So anytime a decision is being made, accessibility needs to be talked about at the very first instance.
Well, I think that's incredibly important what you've just suggested as a corrective to everything that's gone on. When you said, you know, that none of us could look back and think, well, that went well. I think you've got a very good point, and I completely take it on board that, you know, accessibility has to come at the front end of all these processes. I think the only, just playing the devil's advocate, normally I'm cast in the other role, and I'm the one playing the devil's advocate and criticizing LTNs quite strongly on this podcast. But actually, in support of LTNs, and however poorly they've been executed thus far, not all of them, of course, there's been some big positives. I think that, I suppose I've been impressed. How can I express this? I suppose I've been impressed by the call to action that came very quickly and very suddenly, and was, if you like, a little bit autocratic, a little bit handed down, that has excluded precisely your considerations, Katie. I take that on board, absolutely. But I think if we are scratching around and looking for positives in the way these LTNs have been executed, then the speed and the urgency and the realization that something has to give was one of the plus points of the implementation thus far. I guess I'm just, you know, learning now, and it's kind of a real structural error that you weren't absolutely sort of first, uppermost in that process. But do you see some merit in what I'm getting at, that things were moving at a prior to this urgency, things I guess were moving for all of us, both the non-disabled and the disabled community, at a kind of glacial pace, and at least the glacial pace appears to have melted somewhat, if that isn't a rather unfortunate kind of climate change metaphor that I've got myself involved in there.
I think it's an interesting question. But is that a good thing, though, if things move so quickly, but in a way that has excluded so many people? So what you end up with is something that can't be kept in its current format. I think I hear a great deal from people who are pro-LTN. I hate this idea of pro and anti, but that's the best. Those are the best words we've got. I hear from people who are advocates of low traffic neighbourhoods, because, you know, these are not a new idea. This is not a new scheme. These things have existed for decades, and who've kind of been campaigning for these kind of schemes to be implemented for so long, who are really upset at the way in which things have been done because of the backlash. And, you know, you have situations where low traffic neighbourhoods have been put in suddenly and haphazardly, excluded a huge amount of people, have given rise to a huge amount of backlash, have given political people ammunition to campaign against them, and then they just end up being ripped out, and then you end up back where you were. And that's a real shame, and that feels like not a step forward. In terms of acting with haste, I don't see any reason why you can't act with haste, but also mindful of accessibility. I don't understand why accessibility was left out of the conversation. Maybe I will never understand that. I don't understand why disabled people are not taken into consideration. Why we even have to have this conversation. I don't understand why my job exists, to be honest. I don't understand why I spend my life banging on people's doors and telling people, remember that disabled people exist and you can't discriminate against them. To me, the whole thing is quite absurd. I don't think I'll ever understand that. But, doing my best.
I think it's a very fair point, very powerfully put as well. I'll take that on board.
Yeah, it is absurd, the that today in 2021, and it doesn't matter what transport mode you look at, and this is something that you alluded to earlier, Katie, no matter what transport mode you look at, and almost regardless of impairment, it's just there's barriers everywhere, aren't there? If you have some sort of impairment, and you just think the Equality Act was, what was it, 2010? And that was such a long time ago. And there was a long lead up to that, and still nothing, you know, very little has changed. There's sort of pockets of good practice, but it's just, it seems to be across the board. And maybe one good thing that LTNs have brought is the sort of controversy that's created an awareness that's given your kind of your report a bit more traction than you said previous reports haven't sort of got the traction you would have liked. So I don't know, maybe that controversy, as horrible as it's been for people with disabilities, has, you know, maybe I don't know, my hope might be that this would propel this situation, which has been very difficult for some people. One good thing that might come out of it is it might propel this agenda into a sort of more of the public consciousness that this is such an issue for anyone with an impairment.
Yeah, it's another really interesting question. I mean, you mentioned the Equality Act there, which you're right, came into effect in 2010. Before that, we had the Disability Discrimination Act, which came in 1995, the year I was born. So that we celebrated the kind of 25th anniversary of the DDA at the end of last year. And there were a great deal of conversations being had about how things have progressed. Do we think things have gotten better for disabled people in this country? You know, what is the current state of play? And it's hard for me to comment as someone who thankfully has grown up in a world where we at least have a baseline level of accessibility. I mean, we have legislation. I think we at least have the awareness that it's something that we need to be working towards. But the progress is really, really slow, really slow. And I think, I don't know whether things are changing. It's hard for me to kind of step out of the work that I do, and I'm so involved in it, to actually understand, to kind of sense check where we are at. So I don't know whether you'll have heard of this, but something that is really important to the disabled community is the social model of disability. It's the idea that you are disabled not by anything to do with you or your body. You're disabled by the barriers that exist in society. When I can't get on a train, the issue isn't because I can't walk and I use the wheelchair. The issue is there aren't ramps. And that is a socially constructed problem. We have built that. That's a man-made problem. We have essentially created that train station to exist with no ramps. And just as we have built that, we can change that and make it better. And when that problem shifts from the individual to the community, it really lays bare the idea that we have a social responsibility to remove these barriers, that it's a process. It's an active process. We are actively disabling people. We are actively excluding people from accessing society, from equality, from equity. And I think it's really important to consider this when talking about active travel and when talking about any kind of environmental initiative as well. There, I think, exists quite a historic tension, shall we say, between the climate justice movement and the disability justice movement. I think sometimes environmental initiatives have been kind of discussed or implemented that have been seen to exclude or further discriminate against disabled people. I'm thinking about things like the plastic straw ban and things like this. And I think it's so important for the movements to work together. And when, you know, disabled people want to walk, wheel and cycle, we want to make more active travel journeys. And, you know, zooming out to think about the environmental impact of this, you know, disabled people will be among the worst hit by the effects of climate change. That's especially true for things like air quality and pollution, especially when you think about people who have respiratory diseases. So it's really important to include disabled people in the environmental movement and to sort of bring disabled people along within active travel. And that's why it's so important to think about it in social model thinking, to think about the barriers that exist and what we can all do to remove these barriers. And low traffic neighborhoods offer such a good opportunity to have those conversations and think about who we're taking along with that and who we're further excluding.
What you said, Katie, really resonates with just some of the basic experience I have working with local authorities. And you know, recently I did a walk around near where I live and looked at some redevelopments they were doing and just sort of going, like, there's no, and I'm not an expert, but like, there's no drop curb there, like, for example. And now there's going to be a drop curb there, which is like, it's just, you know, great news in a small scheme of things. But I suspect that the low traffic neighborhood discussion, and obviously it's been quite high profile and polarizing, is purely the tip of the iceberg of what I think is probably in councils a general kind of not I don't think anyone's purposefully, you know, maybe by their own actions and they are being discriminatory, but you know, councils have a certain skill set, and I see it in planning all the time. You know, they think about like traffic flow, and they think about certain things, and they're very good at that, but that change, that thinking has changed over the last 30-40 years, and they've not changed with it. So I suspect that councils probably aren't brilliant at all forms of transport when it comes to accessibility, which I think is kind of something that you mentioned, like with the tube stations, for example. I know that's not a council thing; that's a TfL thing. But generally, wherever we go, it's fairly poor. And I think hopefully that the raising of the profile of this issue relating to low traffic neighbourhoods will disseminate across all forms of transport and all other forms of active travel as well. Because one of the things I talk to Isabel from Wheels for Wellbeing a lot about is the very literal barriers that are on things like the National Cycling Network, the kissing gates and things like that. And you just think, how is this stuff? Like, I really can't compute. Like, how did this get hit? How do we get to this point? Yeah. Like, how do we get to this point? It's so shocking. But then there's no one really talking about it. It's a niche issue. Like I spoke to some people in wheelchairs near me who I just saw cycling, using a power cycle. And I said, well, do you find this a problem? And they were sort of, obviously it's only two people, but they were kind of like, well, yeah, but we can take the chairs apart if we have to, you know, kind of thing. And I'm like, that's not good enough. You know, that's not, how do we get to, you know, how do we get to this point? And there's not really a question there, just other than it's a bit frustrating. I hope we're getting to a better place.
It is. I mean, this is like my entire job is this question. And it is baffling. This is, you know, one of the solutions we kind of proposed in our report is something you could do that would be very productive is in any place where you are putting in new street space initiatives. So whether that is a low traffic neighborhood or whether you're putting in new cycling infrastructure or whether you're widening pavements or whatever it is you're doing to the streets, okay, have a look around, do an audit, do an accessibility audit and try and remove the barriers that the very many barriers that exist in that area, because you're there already, you're making changes to the streets. So, okay, there's a curb that hasn't been dropped, asphalt that, you know, remove this kissing gate or whatever it is, just, you know, those kind of smaller things. Because a lot of it is the case of these decisions have been made in the past. We've ended up with this infrastructure that is inaccessible and unusable for disabled people. And I understand that that is the result of disabled people not being visible and present in decision-making in the past. Decisions have already been made. You know, that's certainly true of the Tube Victorian infrastructure. I'm not for a second saying that it would be easy to install lifts in all of the stations overnight. But it's what we can start doing now that would gradually remove those barriers. And that's fine. And that's good. That's productive. That's going in the right direction. What really frustrates me is the things that go in now, new things that get put in that aren't accessible. For me, that's unforgivable. And it's especially true when thinking about these big, expensive decisions, such as acquiring new rolling stock for trains, for example. I won't give names, but there's a very large and very well-used station that used to have step-free access onto their trains. That's step-free as in actual level boarding from the platform to the train. They have acquired new rolling stock for their trains. Their trains are now slightly higher. So that's gone from being a step-free level boarding station to needing a ramp. And that is, rolling stock only gets replaced every, 30 to 40 years. So we now have a situation where that decision has been made. We've acquired this new rolling stock. That has set us up for a legacy of inaccessibility for the next 30, 40 years. To me, that's unforgivable, because these are decisions that are happening now and we really should know better. We should at least know to be talking to the right people. I understand that people are not experts in accessibility. No one can be an expert in absolutely everything. But it's about seeking out the experience, the expertise and the opinions of the people who are going to be dramatically impacted by these changes. When I see cycling infrastructure being put in, and I see cycling infrastructure which is too narrow for a trike or with steps into the cycle lane, or I see filters where you have to disembark, that is immediately unusable for disabled cyclists. Unusable. Some people are able to get off their chair and take apart the chair. For a lot of disabled cyclists, they cannot do that. This is new things going in that aren't going to be replaced for a long time. And it's about this legacy that we're creating. You know, the decisions that are getting made now set us up for decades in the future that we'll still be having the exact same conversations. Putting my lived experience hat on, speaking from a personal perspective as a wheelchair user, I can't tell you the impact that has on me as a person, on my emotional state, on my sense of belonging in this world. Every time I go to a park and there are steps to get into the park, or if I want to go along the New River Walkway to go for a nice walk around the wetlands, and there suddenly is a load of steps, so I have to go along Seven Sisters Main Road instead. Or, you know, every time I have to make these small decisions of changing the way that I go because the nice green walk isn't accessible to me, every time I do that, that is sending me the message of essentially you're not welcome here, or you haven't been thought of in this. And it really does, it just does make you feel so excluded and so kind of othered and removed from the world. And I think it's no surprise that disabled people feel so completely forgotten about, really, and completely left behind a lot of the time. A real, real shame. Really sad to see.
Well, Katie, our time's up. I mean, thank you so much for coming on and making these points. And they're more than points, just calling them points kind of like almost does them a disservice. It's a urgent paradigm shift that's required, and you've articulated it brilliantly. I've got masses to go away and think about. So, and I hope everyone listening to the podcast takes that away as well, because you've done your job over the last hour. Thank you very much, Katie. And I know the report as well took you, I gather, 6 months of your life to put together as well. So thank you for that. It's certainly had an impact, and I'm glad you're getting some sort of positive feedback from the stakeholders, and inching it forward. Hopefully we can change it from inches to great big giant leaps and change the way we're all going about things.
The biggest thing is that this is an open conversation. Yeah. And this is a dialogue, and I think I certainly, from my perspective anyway, the conversation has been so polarized and so heated and quite nasty at some points, and I want to bridge that gap a bit more. And I understand that there is a lot of learning and a lot of understanding that needs to happen. I'm hopeful that the conversation kind of can move on in a more productive way. But thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely to speak to you all.
Well, there we go. Do let us know what you think. I say this every time, using the handle @PodStreetsAhead. Rate us and review us and spread the word as well. Share the podcast with anyone who you think might enjoy it. And we'll see you all next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.